I think a lot of people that listen to today's show are going to say, I needed that. And the reason why is my guest has come through quite a journey to being somebody today who serves the lives of others in such a beautiful way.
I know how much courage it takes for us to ask for help, but it is this courage that creates connection between a doctor and a patient, a teacher and their student, a parent and their child, that we as humans crave.
Her name's Dr. Shahana Alibi, and she's so open about what she struggled with as an individual and how that manifested into eating disorders and anxiety, and how it led her to a degree in medicine and to a higher purpose of helping youth, especially marginalized youth, find their path in life.
Here I was, a family doctor whose job was to work with youth and encourage them to share their own struggles with me. Yet my pride held me back from sharing when the story was my own.
And she offers so much for all of us in terms of what we need to focus on and prioritize and invest in to go after being content and even joy and happiness.
This is Chatter That Matters with Tony Chapman, presented by RBC.
Dr. Shahana Alibi is a TEDx speaker, family physician, and a mental health advocate. She really focuses on integrating the head, heart, and hands, or mental, physical, and emotional well-being. She's a medical lead at one of British Columbia's largest youth health centers, and she invests a lot in helping others manage their mental health through preventative measures. She's also a best-selling author and speaker. Dr. Shahana Alibi, welcome to Chatter That Matters.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I've given you this glowing resume, but you know, if you were on an elevator and that elevator pitch and somebody said, what do you actually do? How would you say that in a few sentences?
You know what? That's such a great way to open up this conversation, because what you've done right there is differentiated my identity versus my values. It's much easier for me to introduce myself as a dinner party and tell you I'm a doctor, I have three young boys, and I love to speak. Done. That sounds pretty good, right? But you know nothing about me. You don't know that I actually love working with marginalized populations. I love working for people who have been dealt a difficult deck of cards, especially our youth. I love cooking. I love the idea of preventative medicine. And I've also come to acknowledge something within me that I, for years and years, really since the age of 4 or 5, struggled with so much shame and secrecy about my own mental health diagnosis. Now, it might take a bit of a longer of an elevator ride for me to go into that, but at the end of the day, that's truly who I am. So I always joke that me as a doctor, mother, speaker, that resume taught me something, but me as a patient taught me everything.
You're from Abbotsford, BC. I just had Nick Taylor on my show. So now I've had two famous people from that town. What is going on with your little part of the world that produces these world-class thinkers, athletes?
I think it's the antioxidants and the berries. We're known for our beer. I'll just go with that. No.
There must be something, because I'm going, I got to go out there. I might have to move there just to become a world-renowned like you two are. So I've listened to a lot of your interviews, an incredibly passionate speaker, and I love your honesty and even how you sort of frame the TED Talks where, you know, I'm going to share something with you. One of the areas that I really paid a lot of attention to is, and maybe in many ways it's the notes that you're playing today, is that your parents' refugee experience from Uganda.
I think anybody whose parents are immigrants to this country, who are refugees, and in my case, my parents were literally kicked out of their country, given 72 hours notice, if that, one bag per family, $50, if that, and sent to the airport to get on any sort of charter out of Uganda. And the premise was all based on the color of their skin. So you can imagine, the one thing is being kicked out of the country you've called home. The other thing is this profound recognition that you are not enough, or you are actually the wrong kind of color. So both of those things influenced my upbringing a lot, because my parents would, of course, relay this story, but they always took a very optimistic, positive spin on it. But I think the foundation there was this very implicit, sometimes explicit message to, you know, don't take for granted our sacrifices, what we've come to this country to hopefully achieve. And the one thing that you can hang on to, one of the things that you know will always be yours and no one can take away from you, is your education. So it wasn't even a question of if you were going for higher education, as this is what you're going to do. And yes, that whole kind of humorous joke about immigrant parents only giving their kids several options. Yeah, that was kind of the case for me. You know, lawyer, maybe. Pharmacist was always the biggest thing. You were going to be a pharmacist. My sister's a pharmacist. My dad's a pharmacist. I was going to be a pharmacist. On the day of the application, I decided, not for me. And for the first time in my life, the first time in my 20 years of life, I actually did something my parents told me to not to do, basically, right? I had never rebelled, never done anything. And I pursued my undergraduate in kinesiology. But I remember my father looking at me and saying, you're going to teach exercise for the rest of your life? Is this what we're actually going to be doing? So that, of course, led into medical school. But the foundation, I trained as a fitness instructor. I put myself through medical school, teaching fitness classes. That passion, that value system was thread throughout my entire life. So I always want people to listen to that inner voice, because you... the path might look so gloomy. It might look so shadowy. You might not be able to see clearly what you're going to make out of this. But I knew, for one, that pharmacy just wasn't for me. And I'm glad I listened to that intuition.
That must create such incredible shifting sand. 72 hours, one bag, $50 if you're lucky. Did they ever feel they were on a firm foundation once they got to Canada? Or how long did it take for them to realize that wouldn't happen again? Because I have to believe when a country abandons you like that, it has to have some lasting impact.
I think, to be honest, it was relief. When you saw the carnage that was happening, when you saw the volatility that was happening on the ground level, when you saw the amount of suffering, the idea that you could get out and you could save your family, and here their first memory of Canada was arriving and the Red Cross cooking them an Indian meal and giving them warm clothes because they came from the equator line. They didn't even know what snow was, right? So all they were met with was this beautiful love and grace and this idea that the world is your oyster. So I think in some ways it was a lot of relief. I'm sure there was anger. I'm sure there was frustration. They relay a beautiful story to me that there was how many of them in a family, maybe 15 or 16, all packed into one small house because that's the way it was. And their blinds were open one day and they were all holding a cup of tea, but nobody was sitting down. So some neighbors were passing by and they look in and seeing 15 people standing and holding a cup of tea. And they knocked on the door and they said, where's your furniture? They said, we can't afford furniture. So the next day, those neighbors brought in some patio furniture to be used inside. And that was how they got their first tables and chairs.
The other part of it that you talked about is sort of the parents and sort of saying, this is a fresh start and we have high expectations in terms, as you said, education's your only path. But as they started to read about your childhood, and you even alluded to it in your beginning, even though you looked perfect on paper, you had a lot of thoughts that you were struggling with.
So I want everyone to kind of rewind 30 years ago. You know, right now we live in a world where if I mention anxiety, depression, OCD, bipolar, most of the times people are gonna at least listen or acknowledge the words that I'm saying. 30 years ago, especially when I was first going through these symptoms, that really wasn't the case. Mental health was even more stigmatized than it does exist today as well. So what you are mentioning is the first recognition of symptoms that I started struggling with since the age of 4 or 5. So I didn't know what these thoughts were called. I just know that they were deeply, deeply upsetting. And it wasn't until 20 years later in medical school, sitting in a psychiatry lecture, that the psychiatrist had put up a slide on the various types of anxiety. And right there on the bottom was a subtype of OCD called pure O, or pure obsessional OCD, which is basically where the person just has intrusive thoughts. The thoughts could be related to harm coming to themselves or their family, or if they were responsible for causing harm. And you can imagine how repugnant and awful these thoughts can be, but you don't have the compulsions. What people portray OCD like on TV, the checking and the cleaning and the checking the lock 600 times, that's not the case with people who have pure OCD. They don't have the compulsion, so it all goes hidden. And oftentimes they're misdiagnosed as just anxiety because, of course, they're anxious about these thoughts, but you're missing the bigger picture because nobody wants to admit what the thoughts are really about. So this started happening to me you know, at a very tender young age. I was lucky enough to talk to my mom about them, but of course, she didn't know what was going on. She did the best that she could. So whenever you don't have a name for something, whenever you feel like you are so unique that you are the only one in not so good of a way, all that leads is to just buckets and buckets and buckets of shame. And that's exactly what happened to me. And you can imagine me just compounding with shame. And the only way out was academia. The only way out to feel like I had some sort of identity was to be the best in school, be the best in undergrad, be the best in medical school. Same story, different setting, right? I call it transactional identity. We all have this in a different way. If I'm pretty enough, if I'm smart enough, if I'm good at sports, then the world has to reward me with something. And most oftentimes, all that person wants is acceptance.
Within that context then of your family, because you're kind of the future now. I mean, they've lost everything they've had. They're in a new country. They're dealing with snow and patio furniture for furniture and stuff, and they're raising a family. Did that add to that, the fact that you were letting them down, or was it just something you found a way to continue to internalize and then, if anything, channel in terms of when you got to school?
It's actually exactly the latter. It was, I couldn't afford to let it leak. I couldn't afford to let the facade break up, right? I had to be that personification of, in my own eyes, perfection. Not that my parents ever would say that you have to be it, but it was this standard that I felt like I had to keep up, right? So there wasn't any time for it. There wasn't any space for it. And all that happens when you start to ignore the thing that your body and mind want you to pay attention to, it just starts to, I always call it Halloween. It just takes on a different costume. So the costume of OCD, the intrusive thoughts, the horrible anxiety just took on a different costume to an eating disorder, which took on a different costume to obsessional exercise, which took on a different costume to depression. If you're not going to treat the root, it's just going to keep changing costumes until you finally go, oh boy, now I have to address it.
To compound all of this, your sister has a severe illness at 19. How did that impact you and your family and what you felt the world was going to offer you?
Probably the most important context to all this is knowing that my sister and I are incredibly close. You know, there's close and then there's the type of close that we are. You know, everyone says we look the same. We're only 19 months apart, except I'm 5'1 and she's 5'8. So, you know, I think we'd have both been better at 5'4. We could have evened things out, but there's a big height difference there too.
I'm not sure she's willing to do that trade. No. You might be.
Exactly. I definitely. Yes, exactly. So my kids are going to outgrow me very fast. So, you know, she ended up getting a severe form of inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, this form of ulcerative colitis at 19, ended up having toxic megacolon, which basically means the colon is about to rupture. So she had to go for emergency surgery and have an ileostomy, like a bag from the outside. And imagine at 19 getting that, right? That, and this is once again, 20 years ago. So even the ostomy care and where it was positioned and the propensity for leakage, things are so much better today. It wasn't like that 20 years ago. It is an embarrassing, difficult, painful thing to reconcile with that as a 19-year-old. So I moved to UBC to be with her. I found myself kind of going not even into the position of an older sister, but the position of a mom to her, you know, cooking, cleaning, making sure that she was okay. And in a very short amount of time, she had to drop out of school because of her illness, and she fought and came back a while later. But I think anybody who has a sibling who has had such chronic health issues, has had such a difficult go in life, I think any sibling often feels guilty. Like, why isn't it me? Why aren't I the one suffering? Why does it all have to be her? And that's what we talk about internalization, the shame in accompanied with the guilt of what's happening with my sister. All of that fueled the need to always control everything, to always make everything right. And that can only sustain you for so long.
As you move on in life, one of the things that you talked about was a great awakening for you is to move away from needing this constant validation, or as you talk about the reward of you're such a great student, you're such a great sister, and moving and focusing on helping others. Do you think the seed was planted during that time with your sister that grew into kind of manifest into who you are today?
Absolutely. I think my parents always, always instilled in us as well, going back to the idea that Canada was the first, like, you know, as this country was the first person, you can think of it as giving them that leg up, giving them that chance. And it was not just the message to educate yourself, but to educate yourself in order to give back, you know, to do your due diligence, to make sure that you have rewarded this country for what they've given us, right? So that seed was planted very early and only flourished and grew, you know, as I took on more of a caregiver role to my sister. And then realizing too that by focusing on me, we were not going to get anywhere. I was still dealing with the shame, still dealing with the guilt. But medicine was such a beautiful career because it was so others focused, right? So I could channel that energy to service. And now I tell the adolescents that I work with, I mainly work with adolescents, that no matter what you choose, even if you are a custodian staff, you are in a job of service. Every occupation must be a service-based profession in order to bring some sort of joy. And it's your job to retrofit your occupation for service.
How difficult is that to get that message across? I call it, by the way, the Yoda mentality, that I'm here to help you get to where you want to go. How difficult is that when we're in a world where we're constantly fed these social media bits and bytes, and it seems to be less about transformation and much more about proclamation?
Yeah, I love that question. I think the dust settles in the examining room. When I can see that patient in front of me and when we're finally clear on what's going on, when there's no noise, when there's no distractions, when there's no need to impress anymore, you finally look at that adolescent and go, okay, like the jig is up. Now we're here. We need to figure this out. Because the way that you've been doing it is not working. I think whether you're 13 years old or whether you're 24 or whether you're 38, you can admit that somewhere along the way, this idea of proclamation isn't working for me. So I need to actually do something different, right? So I think that's where the message of service, because when you start to put your focus and put your energy into that, the only outcome you can possibly have is more happiness. There was a great quote by Dr. Lori Santos, who's very well known for the Happiness Lab podcast. And she said, I dare you to find me a study that shows acts of service do not cause increased happiness. They just don't exist. Like that study does not exist because that is the one thing that does. So that's where we need to put more of our focus and attention, but it's not sexy. You know, sometimes service-based, it's just not a sexy thing. So that's why the one-on-one conversations are so much better to dive deeper.
So if you're not a patient who's dealing with, I just want to find a way out, you're just an average kid out there, youth, how do you instill that very simple philosophy of that serving others is where you'll find your purpose and happiness? How do you get them to buy into that?
So you start to allow them to reflect, right? You know, however old this youth might be, let's say that they're 19, you know, 18, 19, perhaps they worked at a summer camp. Perhaps they volunteered because they had to as part of their high school hours. Then you start to take that experience and go, well, how did that make you feel when such and such happened? How did that actually, when that six-year-old boy came up to you and wanted some help with their arts and crafts, what was going on there for you too? So you just start to tie in the emotion to the experience that they've had. And I think we have the misnomer that every service-based profession, you know, doctor being aside, it has to be completely selfless. It doesn't have to be. Selfless and service don't always have to go together, right? You can be very monetarily focused and still serve a lot of people. I think that is the connection that adolescents need to make, because we do live in a very, in a society where they can call the shots, and that's amazing. But if the more people that you impact, the more successful you likely are going to be. And if I start to create that narrative, I know that they'll start to buy in.
So you team up with New York Times bestselling author Adrian Gostick, and you write this book called Feeling Better. Is it fair to say that part of this book is your memoir of personal struggles with OCD and other mental health challenges, as much as it is your experiences helping others?
I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't have the struggles that I continue to do and did have at the age of four. I just wouldn't. Because the problem is that until it affects you, until the bee actually stings you, then you can empathize and support and advocate all you want. But it pinched me, I felt it. I know what that feels like. So I can speak a common language, and that need for me to come out the other end of what Feel Better is prescribing was bred and thought out from years and years of pain. So I think that's what makes it so real and authentic. And the joke is that you always write the first book for you, for the author. And so this book was written for me, for everyone else.
And when you talk about everyone else, if you could wave a magic wand and saying, after reading my book, not just glancing at it, not just opening a page, but reading it, what do you hope happens in terms of what I call head, heart, and hands, how people think, feel, and behave?
You know, most importantly, I want people to understand that self-acknowledgement, understanding your inner worth, understanding that achievement is much less weighty than progress, precedes self-awareness. You can talk self-awareness all day long, but no one is going to want to introspect if they hate themselves. And that was all born from a phrase that one 17-year-old told me when I finally looked at him and said, "What are we doing here?" I said, "Do you even like yourself?" And he said, "No, Dr. Alibi. I, expletive, 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 hate myself." That's where we need to start, right? So that is one extreme example, but self-acknowledgement precedes self-awareness. And only when you have those two things can you actually be kind and compassionate towards yourself. And the action piece is I want everybody to understand that your emotions are not just cumbersome, but they leave you clues. There's three amazing clues that every emotion leaves you. And if we start to pay attention to those clues, we can start to get more curious. I was asked on another podcast, what is the one single most important emotion everyone can have? And that was one answer I knew right away. Curiosity. We've lost our sense of curiosity because we're so scared. We don't suffer from an epidemic of anxiety or depression. We suffer from an epidemic of not being willing to feel anything at all. We've all become numb. And that's what this book is helping to change.
And what are the other clues?
So one is sensation, how it feels in your body. The second is the story in your head. Many people out there might be like me, and I loved Matlock growing up. That's a long time ago, but there was always a lady in the back of the courtroom when Matlock would be delivering his debrief, and she was typing, right? Typing, typing, typing. That's what your brain is doing. It's that inner typographer typing out everything, right? You have that in your brain, and that's normal. And the last one is significance. Why are you having this emotion in the first place? The bee didn't sting you, if you didn't pinch that shoe, it's only because it matters to you in some way. If I go to a birthday party and see so much wastage of food and people not recycling and all the rest of it, if I didn't have a climate conscience, I'd go, "I don't care, I'm walking out of that party." But if I really was conscious about the climate, I might look at that and go, "Oh, I feel that in my gut. Like that really bothers me." So it all depends on the tug of war between your values and your fears.
And when I read about the pyramid of optimal health, I first went, "Oh, she's going to lose me because everybody has this sort of 40 seconds to curing this or that." But I really took away that this less about the magic wand and more about a mythology in terms of how you get literally your head and your heart and your hands together. It was this sense of optimal health. So tell us a little bit about it. How did you come up with it? Is it easy for people to embrace, or is one of your great frustrations, like, as you said, the environmentalist, "I'm so upset there's waste"? Does it make you upset that something so simple is so often ignored?
So this was actually bred on the back of a paper napkin one day when I think my son must have been 5 or 6 months, and I was at, you know, a version of my rock bottom. And I had to ask myself, after studying kinesiology and nutrition and teaching fitness and going to medical school and all of this stuff that promises to teach you about feeling better and keeping better and making yourself more healthy, how did I get here? Like, how did I literally end up on my knees? So I drew out a simple triangle, and on the bottom, I put the two things that I had been completely neglecting. One is called think better. The idea that your brain's job is not to keep you happy. Many of us have heard this phrase, but the brain just craves what's familiar. I had no clue that I had an inner narrative. I had no clue that my emotions were trying to teach me something. I had no clue. Right? Your emotional health is as much biology as it is biography. It's the way that your parents sorted out a disagreement. It's the way that your teacher approached you when you were struggling. It's the way that your coach came up to you and taught you how to approach or avoid a particular technique issue that you might be having with your sports. It's all of that. So emotional health is not about learning. It's about unlearning. Unlearning so many of these coping mechanisms and defense styles that we all have. And the second thing on the foundation was connect deeply. Equally as important and related to service is the idea of having people that you can truly be authentically yourself with, right? This is why we talk about loneliness as an epidemic. This is why in the Harvard longitudinal study, when they looked at all of the metrics, the authors of the study said, I don't need to know your glycemic index. I don't need to know your cholesterol levels. All I need to know is how well connected you are for me to know whether you are going to live a long and happy life. Like, that is a profound statement. And truth be told, I had let a lot of my friendships go. I didn't know how, it sounds embarrassing to admit this, but I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know that you needed to invest in other people. I was so invested in myself, in my education, in my family, in my career, that I wasn't really invested in other people. And all the friends that I had made had slowly, of course, drifted away. That's why those two things are at the bottom. I spent all my time focusing on the meat of the pyramid. Exercising, like I talked about, exercising a lot. Fine, not a bad idea, but not so great when you're not connected and you're not training your brain. And eating smart, right? So are you making better decisions about how you're eating every day? The third piece that we now are learning more about is, I call it rest smart. So it's not about meditating. It's not about wearing an Aura ring so you optimize your sleep. It's, are you quiet in your day? Full stop, period. I can't even be quiet for 5 minutes at a time. I struggle with that. I always need something on. And that's what I'm working towards. And at the top is, why are we having this conversation in the first place? Are you fulfilling a message that's beyond an I to a we? Are you actually, do you have a sense of purpose? Do you have a sense of fulfillment, right? So that optimal health pyramid, I always joke with my patients as well, is that even if you scored 7 out of 10 in each of those categories, you might not be happy, but you darn well should be content. Because what I had was a 10 out of 10 in my nutrition, a 10 out of 10 in exercise, but I was failing in social connection, failing in resting well, failing in training my brain. And I didn't really understand what my purpose was or why I was doing the work I was doing.
This incredible book comes out. You must be very delighted, even though, as you said, it's often the first book is for you and others. Mel Robbins provides an endorsement on many notable figures. How did that make you feel that other people saw themselves in the book, not just the author who wrote the book?
That little four-year-old girl is smiling right now because I lived so many years feeling so alone. And now it's so much easier to share with strangers. But can I be like, I was terrified of giving the book to other extended family members. I was terrified of giving the book to friends, of people who knew me as this facade of me and actually being real and authentic. So to know that people who are in higher echelons or who are in higher celebrity status also see themselves in that just makes us all human, right? I think that's the thing. And I'm so happy to turn this shame that I've held on for so long. It's still hard. I'm not saying it's not hard, but into a tenet of this superpower.
And how would you score yourself today on that pyramid? Are you content?
I am content. Yeah. Do I still have pure obsessional OCD? Yes. Does it still terrify me at times? Yes. Is it hard to talk about? Yes. But I'm so much further along than I was. I love the work that I'm doing. And you know what the best part is? Me as a physician fulfilled part of me, but it didn't allow me to be creative. As a physician, you're so scared. I'll just be blunt, of killing somebody. You're so scared of making an error. At least that's how I feel. You feel like you're walking around with a cloud constantly. It's like, don't miss this and don't miss that. And make sure you ask about this. This, having conversation, using words as art pictures, creating presentations, creating concepts, that's allowed me a creativity that I didn't know I so needed and wanted. So I just want to say, even if you've spent 10, 12 years in school, it's okay to color outside the lines. Whatever your profession that you've done and invested in, you can form it to make it something that you truly go, oh my word, like this is what I love to do. And there's so much of this that's still hard, but when I do get a chance to talk and share these ideas, I know it's all worth it.
When we return, more with Dr. Shahana Alibi, and then I offer my three takeaways that I hope I apply to my life for the rest of my life.
Hi, this is Tony Chapman, host of the radio show and podcast Chatter That Matters. Did you know that only 1 in 5 youth with a mental health illness can get access to the care they need? Well, a big shout out to the RBC Foundation and RBC Future Launch for supporting over 150 youth mental health organizations. And in doing so, they help youth and their families get the care they need and deserve.
We cannot fool ourselves into thinking that what we teach our kids in the classroom will not directly affect the conditions we see in our clinics. It is this kind of collaboration that we need more of. Physicians and educators sitting at the same table, each with our unique lens, but a common goal: to move this conversation forward.
You're listening to Chatter That Matters with Tony Chapman, presented by RBC.
Dr. Shahana Alibaugh matters because she's a renowned family physician with a special focus on mental health and particularly maternal mental wellness. She's also an expert speaker, media commentator who passionately advocates for destigmatizing mental health struggles. What I like about her is her insights are not only drawn from her clinical expertise, but also from her personal experiences. And to me, that makes her a powerful voice on topics such as mindfulness, emotional resilience, and self-care. You're in a profession where you are more often than not very in control. I mean, the patient-doctor relationship. I'm curious, you know, when you talked about connections, I didn't invest enough, and it wasn't for you to invest that. You have to let go of that control. You have to realize that this is no longer just your agenda. It's a collective agenda. And very often it's somebody else's quest. How have you found yourself doing that when the stethoscope is off and this is just having a coffee with somebody you adore?
You hit the nail on the head with control, right? Because I think going back to the idea that emotional health is not just biology, it's biography. That's how I grew up, right? I think the idea that I could, the more that I can control, the more that I could just predict everything, then I didn't have to deal with the nemesis of uncertainty. But of course, when you're opening yourself up to other people, i.e. friends, colleagues, acquaintances, I think I've had to learn to be more transparent and embrace this psychological phenomenon called the beautiful mess effect, which means basically if you know, like, and trust me, and I share this intimate detail with you, like a mental health diagnosis, that you actually will like me more. And that's a fact, right? People have shown that if they actually share something vulnerable with other people who already respect them, the audience actually likes them more. So I've really had to put that to the test with my friendships and my relationships and force myself to be a little bit more vulnerable so that my friends can be vulnerable as well, right? And to take the agenda off the table too. For the longest time, it was just, you know, find a partner, get married, have kids. It was just following this very fairy tale type of thing, which doesn't exist, and you feel very lonely. So having to branch out and actually think outside of that was really important.
One of your favorite quotes: you are not a drop in the ocean, but the entire ocean in every drop. Why did that move you?
Because that's why I do the work I do with the adolescents. So many of these adolescents have had backgrounds that will make your toes curl. They've been dealt a very difficult card. And when I see them, I want it to be more than here's a prescription. I want it to be more than, you know, here, just go for some counseling. I want to see them who they are, like for the full picture of who they are. One of the first questions I ask them is that when this is all said and done, when you've graduated or when you've completed your own schooling, what do you want to do? And a lot of them will look at me and go, I don't know. But then I had one that who told me something and she said, I'm not allowed to dream. And I said, why? She's like, because I will end up like every other person in my family who's either selling themselves on the street, who's either drug addicted or who's passed away. It's like, that is going to be my future. And she was so sure of that because that's all the role models that she had. So the purpose of that appointment was to make her feel that she is the entire ocean in a drop, and she is allowed to dream.
Another quote, we do not suffer from a lack of joy, simply from a lack of recognizing joy.
There's this famous experiment that was done where participants have to look at a video and basketball players are passing a ball back and forth. And suddenly in the middle of the screen, a giant gorilla appears and beats his chest and moves off the screen. So you would think that it's kind of hard not to spot a giant gorilla in the middle of a basketball scene. But those people who were asked to use their phone while watching this video, approximately a very high percentage, 80, even 90%, didn't see the gorilla. And I've realized for a very long time with the three young kids that I've had that I've missed so many gorillas. I've missed so many things in their upbringing because I've been so distracted, or I've been so overwhelmed that I've purposely been distracting myself. So I always imagine joy like a piece of gum. We all know the kids who used to do that is take it off the desk and then take it and then try to stretch it for as long as possible. So I call it joy stretching. So the idea being is that when you have that moment, whatever it is, something really small, you're kissing your kids goodnight, you're reading them a bedtime story, you know, you're hugging your spouse when you come home from work, that millisecond of contact, can you stretch it out so that it means 5 minutes to you? Can you stretch it out by thinking about the sights, the sounds, the smells, the sensations you're having in that time? So our job is not to start looking for joy. It's to start actually recognizing all the joy around us and stretching it for every bit it's worth.
You have so much to offer. What's next for you in terms of taking this petri dish of your life and turning it into a book and a pyramid of optimal health? Like, where do you see yourself in 5 years that, you know, the last 5 years, I found a lot of joy?
I need to avoid the shiny objects. I need to avoid the things where you are taking the message away from the surface and you're creating it just into, you know, a catchy Instagram post. Like, that's not what I want. I was talking to a coach the other day and she said, Shahana, she's like, this is the Wild West. She's like, you thought medical school was hard? All of this branding and marketing and trying to tell your story, there's so much noise. So I think sometimes sifting through that noise and trying to figure out what is the best medium to reach more people. And sometimes, honestly, it's stage by stage by stage. I love speaking. I love getting up in front of a group of 10 to 1,000 people and relaying this message, because there is always usually a woman who comes up to me and says, this is what I needed to hear right now. And that is the same woman that I would see in my office later on, right? So perhaps right now it's just stage by stage. And perhaps all I need to do is stop the noise, stop looking for the shiny object, and keep focused on serving others.
Shahana, I always end my shows with my three takeaways. And the first one was at the very beginning, where you talked about the difference between identity and values, and how often we're so caught up in our identity or how we want people to perceive us. And I don't mean that just in a resume or a LinkedIn profile, but I would say a lot of people chasing false social media stereotypes and really focusing on what we value. And I think that humanity was to move to that point, I think we'd see that we're all one human race, and that more often than not, people are very good and interested in helping others. But I think when we lose ourselves in our identity, it becomes much more about me versus we. I love the concept of curiosity and how we've lost the ability because we fear rejection, we fear failure. Beautiful story of that girl who said, I'm not allowed to dream because I know where I'm going to end up. All of these things. I think this sense of keeping that curiosity alive, because inside it, we will unlock this, as you said, this brain that wants to think, and this emotions that want to connect, and this incredible bias for service and action and helping other people go. So I thought that was incredibly beautiful. The last thing I want to say that I learned from you is, when you talked about shiny objects, with your credentials, your stage presence, with your thought leadership, you could spend your entire life unwrapping shiny objects. But instead, you really walk the talk. You just want to be on stage and sharing what you believe with others. And I think that if you stay true to that course, I think there's going to be thousands, if not millions of people that are going to benefit from the pyramid of optimal health and the words of wisdom from Dr. Shahana Alibi.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure getting to know you better. Such a pleasure to be able to share my story, speak my own truth, and hopefully leave some people with some great things to think about.
Chatter That Matters has been a presentation of RBC.
It's Tony Chapman. Thanks for listening. And let's chat soon.